Hello, I'm Alex Sotaro.
And I'm Alex Goldstein.
We're a couple of TV nerds with opinions, and this is The Thing That Gets You to The Thing, a Halt and Catch Fire fan podcast.
This week, we finally reached it, the season finale, episode 10 of season 1. It's called 1984, and it's pretty explosive.
It's a big milestone for us. So this episode, we'll be looking into all the usual things like plot, character, direction, design, and all that jazz. But next time, we're going to do a one-off episode looking back at the whole season and looking forward to the next.
As chance would have it, by the time you hear this, I think Amazon Prime will have actually removed Halt and Catch Fire from the UK platform. But we do know, as far as we know, it's still available on Netflix in the UK. It's still available on a number of platforms in other places. Of course, you can still buy the box set. And we encourage you, if this is your first watch along and you're watching it in the UK, to find somewhere else to watch it ASAP. Because it's, you know, the first season is great, but we're about to really kind of floor the pedal. So it's really worth finding it wherever you are. Okay, then. Let the giant celebrations begin.
Oh, I'm so sad about the Amazon Prime situation. I feel like it was an avenue for so many people. Hopefully it sort of jumps to Netflix or somewhere, frankly, a bit bigger.
Yeah, it's just like 2020. Do you want to take anything else from us? Because no. Like, I've had enough of this.
A sad one.
No. Just give us this thing, this one thing. But I mean, look, I'm perfectly prepared to buy the box set. Obviously, it's my third watch, your second. We know that most of the people listening to this have watched it before, whether or not they kind of remember it well or not, they sort of remember it fondly. So it's hopefully worth it for the people who are in the UK. But for those who aren't, I think the streaming options are still there. And I know the distribution deals don't stack up neatly by region, but I can only hope that if Netflix had it in the US, that won't put them off acquiring it here, maybe.
Yeah, let's see what happens. Anyway, we'll keep you guys posted. We want to make sure that all of you can, you know, if this is your first time, watch along. So we finally made it to the finale. I can finally unleash the gifts of Joe setting the truck on fire.
We've been waiting for this. We've been like, I don't remember that much about what happens in the last episode, but we all remember the fire.
We all remember the fire.
We're just like, we need those gifts.
I mean, to be honest, this is part of why I really enjoy the rewatch, just because you get certain things stuck in your head and that's what you sort of roll with. I just finished rewatching The Americans for the second time and I sort of knew I was coming and I forgot some of the little nuanced things in between. So it was fun to rediscover that here as well. And obviously we've got Juan José Campanella sort of back directing this episode.
Yes.
And you can tell, right?
We've gone full circle back to the first episode where we've got the same director, we've got the original showrunners and co-writers kind of running the whole thing. And it feels like it too, right?
Yeah, it does feel like its usual sort of cinematic essence, I guess. It feels more pure than maybe some of the other episodes. And again, it feels, well, we touched on the fact briefly that the plot points here aren't as maybe revolutionary or forward-thinking as, or even as shocking as some of the previous episodes, but it tends to, or it feels like one of those episodes where it is driving somewhere, like there is an endgame in mind for all these things to take place.
Yeah. I'm going to say that as an end of season, as the season finale goes, it does exactly what it needs to do, which is to tie up as many loose ends as it can, but leave one or two really good sort of hanging questions.
Yeah.
So we sort of, the drama of Gordon and Donna's relationship has actually more or less, despite the kind of like dramatics of the last episode, it sort of more or less worked itself out. They found a way forward. And here they sort of reaffirm that relationship. But we now have this big question mark over what Donna is going to do next. And she accepts the job from Cameron. And it's like, what on earth is that going to look like? So there's that. And we know that Joe is back on the road again and we don't know where he's going to go. So they're really big things. But then all the little tiny details of, did they sell the giant? Yes, they sold the giant. Did they, you know, did they save their marriage? Looks like it. Did Joe and Cameron work out? No. So, you know, at least we kind of have the big questions answered, more or less in ways we expected as well.
Yeah, I mean, something still jumped around quite quickly in my eyes, and we sort of touched on this in the last episode, mostly the Cameron storyline about her working behind the scenes. I mean, there's clearly a time jump, but when Donna references to Gordon, come on, it's been a week. Come sleep in bed with me. And then you have Cameron again in her storyline of having set up this sort of secret company that is, I guess, inventing dial-up internet, essentially, which is quite cool. I hadn't remember them jumping on this so quickly. And so it feels like there's a little bit of a gap missing, very much like I felt when the whole embezzlement thing happened, where it was just, I guess, it happened off camera. It's been building for a while. You just don't really necessarily see it. So that felt a bit jarring to me. But it is fascinating how quickly that injected life into the show, because you basically have this two sides at the moment. You've got Cameron with Donna accepting that job, and we'll talk a little bit more about those initial scenes between them, which I think were really well made, because it wasn't just we'll forget everything, we'll jump right into bed together.
Yeah.
And on the other side, you've got Gordon sort of sitting alone in this big conference room thinking, so what now? What's next?
Well, he reminded me very much of, there's a comic poem for kids by Roger McGough that goes, can I be the leader? It's called The Leader. And it goes, can I be the leader? Can I be the leader? Can I? I can. Promise. Yippee. I'm the leader. Okay. What do we do?
Right.
And that really reminded me of him, because he's like, he's fought and fought and fought to be seen as the serious side of this project, to be seen as somebody who knows what they're doing, to be seen as somebody with vision. Yep. And then the minute that's handed to him and Joe isn't there to prop up the other side of it, he has absolutely no idea what he's doing. And I mean, that in itself is an interesting question of, you know, where does Gordon go from here for season two? But that's something we can kind of dig into when we do the season wrap.
The whole scene was set up in a beautiful way. I think the close-ups on Gordon, some of the lighting, some of the shining his glasses. I think, you know, his clean shave, which now for me is sort of synonymous with I'm mentally okay, whereas in some of the episodes where he's been mentally unstable, you can tell by his appearance. So I think they've sort of nailed those looks. Yeah. And so you're right. It's kind of like, this is where we find out the difference between a Gordon and a Joe, not necessarily in relation to the work they put in or the hands-on experience they each have individually, but rather the fact that, you know, Joe is willing to, for better or worse, just literally set the whole thing on fire.
But it's very obvious that the one can't exist without the other.
Of course.
So Gordon can do, but he can't see. And Joe can see, but he can't do. And what's really interesting is then we now have this emerging dynamic between Donna and Cameron. And you really, like, Donna has more or less aligned herself with Gordon's side of things. She is more of a doer. And Cameron has very clearly, you know, set out her stall as a visionary. And in fact, in this very episode, she talks about the fact that she thought she saw that in Joe, but it wasn't a heartbeat, it was an echo, right? She knows that she's a visionary, or at least she trusts in her vision. And the question is, you know, when it's these two women, not just because they're women, but because they are who they are, is it going to play out in the same way that Joe and Gordon did? Or having learned from the giant, having learned from that mistake, I mean, Cameron then sets her stall out, doesn't she? And she goes, you know, it's not about bosses, it's not about titles. Are they going to be able to fight the curse effectively of this, or are they going to be able to address this seesaw that seems to happen between the visionary and the person who actually does the job?
Well, it also feels like Cameron walked away with the right people, with the right attitude out of all of this almost, right? Whereas
also she can do stuff, which Joe couldn't. she has skills.
That's true, but I also wonder what would have happened if Cameron didn't leave Cardiff, and what the dynamic would have been like between Gordon and Cameron, because we get that really nice scene a couple of episodes ago with them in the arcade and sort of bonding a little bit and sort of uniting for a greater cause, which is to sort of reignite Joe's appetite for the giant to then get to Comdex. Now that's sort of falling apart a little bit. And so, I mean, I think Donna makes a lot more sense. She's been sitting in the sidelines. It's actually quite nice, and we'll talk about this in the season wrap-up probably, but it's been nice that she gets this arc where in this episode, she's just completely messing up that assessment that this guy is giving her so that she can get fired. Gordon picks her up, kind of like when she picked him up from jail, in that similar style of, okay, I'm coming to get you this time around. And it's nice for her to have more purpose, but also allowing herself the space to just like be unemployed and just think things through and not really care so much. I feel like we never really understood Donna's motivations for staying where she was, because even though Gordon never asked her, like we saw in episode 9.
And finally he does now. And she's able to say no.
Yeah. And she's had plenty of opportunities. She's had plenty of windows to sort of jump ship. So it's kind of funny how things work out from that point of view. And I think one of the things, and I'm not going to spoil anyone, but the show did air and it has 4 seasons, as we know. And one of the things that I really like about Halt and Catch Fire is how they very quickly try different pairings to understand what works. And this is one that I'm really excited about.
I mean, I think this is what really sets it apart from, and again, we can talk about this more in the season wrap up, but it's one of the things that I think sets the show apart from its predecessors. It sets it apart from a Mad Men or whatever, that it moves from something that has a central character with enough interesting supporting characters that you can almost call it an ensemble, to something that is genuinely an ensemble. Like, they started out putting Joe in the hot seat. And yes, Lee Pace going in was the one with the most kind of credits to his name and the most established fan base. But very quickly, even in this first season, we've seen a quite substantial shift towards other people's viewpoints throughout the whole thing. And now that Joe has set everything on fire and walked off into the sunset on his own. Now, obviously, you know, again, it's not a spoiler to say it had 4 seasons and we know he was in them. So we know Joe comes back in some way, shape or form. But we also know that at the end of the first season, the show has set out its stall and gone, this guy is walking off to do something else. And these people are starting something new. And the bulk of the people that you know and care about are staying put right here to do something. And putting that in the hands of 2 women is unusual after something like Mad Men, which was sort of very male ego-centric. Yeah. I know it had Peggy as well and Joan, but it always sort of came back to Don. Here you've got something where you genuinely don't know if the next season is actually going to be much more heavily weighted in Cameron's hands or even in Donna's. And on Donna, just while we're on her, I honestly think that she, if anyone's going to get the crown for this episode, it is Carrie Bechet, because firstly, that woman needs a comedy.
Carrie Bechet appreciation moment.
Huge appreciation moment, because she's so funny.
Yes.
I'd completely forgotten how absolutely hilarious she is. Like, both the appraisal scene where she basically talks them into firing her, and then later when she gets a bit baked.
Yes.
They are both really funny scenes, and her timing is impeccable. And I really need someone to write her a comedy, because I think that she would be amazing.
If you're listening, we want more Carrie Bechet. Whoever's listening, that's all we got to say on that.
Guys, we just need a comedy for her.
Please. I mean, she really cements her own spot, I think, throughout the season. And I think this episode really shows us this kind of other side of her, where actually up until the very end, she's just kind of hanging out in the sidelines. And, you know, the thing she tells Gordon about the printer status codec thing that's printed out, like, Joe doesn't know that.
And Joe doesn't know that. It's such a good line.
It is. And I love that Gordon almost used it as well before Joe told him straight up that, you know, they should change course or whatever. But I think there were a lot of really clever things. The entire Joe and Gordon dynamic with Nathan Cardiff was also, I think, really clever in the way that they managed to get what they wanted, or seemingly what they wanted, in terms of a percentage of the company. Now, the thing that I don't really understand is whether they're sort of doomed or not, right? I mean, Joe clearly leaves, Cameron clearly leaves. What is that stock worth now? Like, are you just standing in a pile of ashes? Because we are sort of thrown into this loops of celebration, that moment when Gordon picks up the giant, gives one to Debbie, and then he freaking throws it out in the trash when he yells at her, which I really did not appreciate.
No, I mean, that really shows Gordon's worst side, doesn't it? I mean, I early on, we got a few comments on the podcast going, man, you guys are really hard on Gordon. It's like, yeah, but he does things like this. Like, he's not a nice person. a lot of the time.
He doesn't stop.
No. And he's always on the lookout for someone else to blame because...
Of course.
He gets blamed so often, but it's often his fault. So...
But I mean, this is a little foreshadowing on the industry. It's like, Gordon, you're in charge of this now. You need to understand that you will get returns, that there will be manufacturing issues, that the machine that you build in your head might not manifest physically the way that you thought it would. And I feel like so far they've gotten away with that with, you know, the screen technology and some of the other stuff. With them removing the soul of the machine, as it were, it is kind of Gordon's machine now. He's got to take care, you know, he's 100% responsible for that.
It is. And I think that just goes straight back to the scene that you and I both really liked with that kind of long shot over the table, which, and the table just seems to feel longer and longer and longer.
Endless.
During that shot. It's really beautifully set up and beautifully lit. And that, Gordon is very aware of the dilemma, I think. I think he realizes that, you know, they did the thing and they were all, it was all fun and games at Comdex and it was all kamikaze and just trying to get the job done. And then, you know, he got really ruthless and ripped out the soul of the machine in order to sell it just to beat Hunt, because that was like a personal affront to him, because this was a man who also kind of tried to move in on his wife as he sees it. And I think as all of us saw it to some extent. But now that he's done it, he's sort of really aware that you're only as good as the next thing you do well in this industry. And the pace on that is about to accelerate rapidly, right? Like we already need, like technology has always been like that, but now the gap between one thing and the next thing is tiny, where it used to be sort of months or possibly even years. Now it's, you know, matters of days.
Yeah.
That's landed on his shoulders. And I think we're supposed to know that he's super aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, we as consumers know that there are two realities. There's the reality that consumers see, which is release dates for big tech coming out. And there's the manufacturer and the company side where they're building three things at once and releasing them on different schedules. And I think there was no way he could have gotten to grips with that.
Yeah, or building 15 things at once and sometimes not releasing any of them.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see Gordon continue or get out of this situation that he finds himself in. But again, it feels more doomed than anything else. And I, you know, yes, you've got Dunn and jumping ship to Cameron, and they kind of fixed their relationship to an extent, both between Dunn and Cameron, or initially anyway. Like there's some defrosting going on there, and Gordon and Donna. But yeah, I mean, is he gonna sink in that seat? Is that why Joe got out? I mean, these are all really interesting things. And, you know, Joe is sort of, he really takes a step back in this episode, I think, right? I mean, like, he's physically present.
He emotionally switched off the minute he saw the Mac, right? So we saw that at the end of the previous episode. And he doesn't come back in this episode, really. Emotionally, he doesn't check back in.
Well, Joe is the kind of person that you can imagine checking out in different stages, right? Like it can be when things are already ready to go and it's a matter of releasing it. Maybe he doesn't care. And he's just like, okay, I'm on to the next thing. Like I want the shiny new thing. And no, I mean, he really did sort of stick through all the way. But the Mac commercial was great because there were comments from Gordon saying things like, it doesn't even show the computer. And it was great. It was really great to see. Remember the iPod commercial, the original one, which were the silhouettes?
Yep. I figured it was a direct reference to things like that, that, you know, the sort of Apple has a long history of, to paraphrase, thinking differently, particularly about marketing and advertising and display and what you think a machine should look like and what you think a user interface should look like and what you think an ad for a machine should look like. And it was funny because when Gordon said that, like you and I have both worked in agency and we've both seen what very good client feedback looks like and also what not so great client feedback looks like. And you always know that the client that's going to do the less exciting, less successful work is the one that's incredibly literal. And here, Gordon is being a deeply literal client.
Exactly. He has been from day one. I mean, don't forget the designs for the actual casing. And he was kind of like, just give him a gray box. I mean, to me, it's really interesting that the show really picks up on these things in a way that allows the characters to, you know, in essence, sort of shrug it off and be like, yeah, ours has this and that. And that short-sightedness is where I'm looking forward to seeing where that gets Gordon, because he is so content with not having to do more than he has to. And we've seen this throughout the season that, you know, reality is knocking And there's no more Joe to filter that reality through in a way that translates it into what you want to hear for you to be able to do it. And to be fair, like, I can't blame him. He's been in that organization for, what, 20 years? He is now, like, kind of, what, heading up Cardiff Electric? I mean, it sounds wild to think about it. We'll dive deeper into this when we do our wrap-up. But he got everything he wanted.
He did.
But...
And you know, can he do anything with it? And the interesting thing about Gordon is that he is at heart a deeply conventional person. He wants his wife and two kids and house in the suburbs and job and respect, but he wants to be seen as a creative and a visionary. And in a way, that's quite curiously encapsulated in the way that he sort of reproposes to Donna with the ring, right? So the ring is the nerdiest thing I've ever seen. I mean, the whole I doff you very GURP scene is like,
oh, yeah,
nerds on stilts.
Oh God.
But it's still a really conventional thing to do. It's sort of dressed up in layers of quirky. I don't say this as a criticism at all, because I too have a sort of fairly conventional home-loving heart. But it's, you know, he's doing everything that he's supposed to do. He's finally getting her the ring because it kind of ticks a box and fulfills a contract that he feels he needs to make. He did the computer, he delivered what he was asked to deliver and a bit more, and got it out the door and sold it, and he got his paycheck and his contract and all the rest of it. And that is ultimately what makes him so different from Joe. It is what, in a good way, makes him able to do stuff. Like, Joe gets so lost in his own vision that maybe he'll never get to the end point of creating something to sell. He's so good at selling it that he forgets he's got to have something in his hands to hand over. And Gordon is the person who's sort of running behind, trying to fill it. But he is at heart a quite conventional soul. And now he's got to the top of the ladder and it's like, what am I looking at here? What am I supposed to do from up here?
Yeah, I did love the very, very first scene where someone is doing the dishes and they're out of focus and Donna's talking and it's finally Gordon doing the dishes, right? And he's not taking any help. But I just love those subtle touches. And if we can shift to some of that camera work, I mean, we touch on it. Like, for example, the long table scene. There's actually a scene where Joe and Gordon are sort of facing off against Nathan, trying to get their percentage of the company. And there's a very long shot from outside the office that's just complete darkness that actually looks a bit like an interrogation room / weird freaky lab. And I love those, getting those touches of almost sinister darkness back in, infused with the storyline, because it is, you know, it's not a dark scene by any stretch of the imagination, but you don't know who this guy is, or because we don't truly know Nathan Cardiff. We know he's ruthless when it comes to the people.
No, and we suspect that maybe he had, maybe he's the one that had Joe beaten up if it wasn't Boz in a weird kind of personality clash thing. Like, we know that he yells at Boz and threatens him. Like, he's not a pleasant character, but we don't really know very much about his motivations, why he got into this business, just that he's been in it for a really long time.
Yeah, and we get a lot of more tilted shots. Again, I feel like they're so exaggerated in this episode. I mean, I loved it.
I felt like I was on the Titanic. The whole thing seemed tipped to, like, one side. And it's funny because I don't remember a lot of those from the first two episodes, which obviously we had the same director. It also had Juan José Campanella.
I don't think that they were as
but
pronounced.
I do remember them.
Yeah, no. They were there in, you know, wider shots between, like, a conference room scene or whatever.
The first time I remember one being so pronounced was actually Karen Kasama in episode 3. She does it in a scene with Boz and Joe. And I remember we talked about it in the episode because I was like, whoa, okay, that scene, like, it was the first time in ages that I'd really noticed a shot set up so obviously. And it's quite lovely in a way to see that, you know, something that he started to a slightly more subtle in a slightly more subtle way in episodes 1 and 2 that then was that other directors picked up and ran with, and then he's coming back to it and, like, doubling down on it and being like, okay, we're gonna do this, we're gonna really, like, commit to-. I love that continuity in a show that's had, you know, probably 6 directors over the course of the season.
I mean, it's great. And I'll give you a fun one. Let's see if I can explain it without actually showing it. But essentially, the very last 2 frames are tilted the complete way around. So you got Gordon looking over the dark office, tilted all the way to the left. And then you've got Joe getting lost in the woods where he's going stargazing as the last shot of the episode, completely tilted to the right.
Oh my God, that's beautiful.
There's your seesaw.
It's incredible.
How poetic.
I know.
No, it's great. And I do think he brings a lot to the table. Pun intended, I guess, talking about so many conference rooms. But he really is sort of the soul of the show, I think, from that point of view. I mean, I'm sure it all came to be in part of the vision that Christopher Cantwell and Rogers had in mind. It really does feel like visually he helped define what the show would be. And I continue to watch and love tons of shows set in the 70s and in the 80s. I just finished The Americans again. I'm watching Cobra Kai, which is set in the present time, but it is dressed up as 80s, like the music, the tech that the characters use, the flashbacks. And it's above and beyond that. I feel like he does a lot with very little. How do you put a spin on such an iconic era? And I feel like he manages to do that by really making his characters his own and not take the backdrop of the real world as serious as we need it to, until you get things like the Mac advert and all that stuff, right?
Absolutely. There are so many ways to do 80s, and there are some shows that have it easier than others. Like, so this week we got the news that the last season of GLOW won't happen because of the pandemic, which a lot of people are really upset about, and me included, because I think it's an absolutely wonderful show. GLOW does, with costume and with the ridiculous premise, what Halt and Catch Fire does with the technology and the kind of rate of change and things like that. It grounds itself through those things. And I refer to Stranger Things a lot with this, and it's not that I think it's a bad show. I don't at all. I really enjoyed the first season. I didn't feel any need to watch any others, but I was just kind of done with the thing. But I felt like that was relying a bit more on kind of cultural markers and, you know, kids' costumes and things like that to keep reminding you that it's the 80s, because the premise of the show and the story of the show doesn't have to be in the 80s. They're setting it in the 80s because it's a bit of a nostalgia trip, and maybe because kids have a bit more freedom to run around and play in the woods. But, you know, it's not based on the fact that it's there, whereas neither of these other two shows, neither GLOW nor Halt and Catch Fire, can take place at any other time. They are rooted in a particular bit of history. And that's why I think they kind of do it so well. They evoke a feeling so well. And Halt and Catch Fire chooses to take it through a slightly less neon and obvious route. It's a bit darker. It's a little bit more eerie. That shot that you were talking about, that really distant one, like, it felt really properly cinematic. And I love that about it. I love how beautiful it is and also how not obvious it is.
Stranger Things is a very interesting example of this, because actually it's kind of emulating your Spielberg's look and feel, right? Which represents films of that era.
Yeah.
You know, from the 80s. It is a really interesting proposition, I think, because you are going for the iconic film stuff that speaks to that area versus the more realistic, if that even exists anymore, because we live, you know, again, I've never lived in the 80s. I wouldn't be able to tell you, unfortunately, how it was. It looked really fun.
I mean, I can tell you, but I was very small, so it's going to be a very warped perception.
I'm sure you had a great time. But actually, I started, is it Ratched? 5 minutes in.
Yeah.
And I turned to my sister. I'm like, is this a Ryan Murphy show? She was like, no. I'm like, no. Let me check. I check on the credits. It's a Ryan Murphy show. They're all the same, right? No offense to Ryan.
Look, he's found his formula and he's making it work for him.
I mean, totally.
I take my hat off to the hustle.
This is like his third show or fifth show. I mean, if you count the American Horror Story, sort of standalone, they're all standalone seasons anyway. But like set in this sort of like 30s, 40s, 50s, glam, Art Deco.
He has a look. He has a look and a half, and he's really committed to it.
I like the fact that Halt and Catch Fire has its look. Actually, this episode had a lot of jump cuts in the edits, which was quite interesting,
yes.
Right?
And some quite queasy editing. I mean, that scene at the beginning where Gordon is singing Ride of the Valkyries running through the office and opening the box. And it was kind of cringy, right? You felt the full body
cringe
at Gordon being cringy, but you were also happy for them. But that was edited. Like, I actually wrote down, I feel a little bit sick. Like, I feel a bit drunk watching the editing because it moves so fast. And that's not something you see a lot of in this show.
You tend to see it more when showcasing Gordon and following him around.
Yeah. Or occasionally when Cameron's working, when you get that freneticism of her being in the zone. But yeah, you're right. That kind of off-kilterness, that fast pace is very Gordon associated.
Sorry, you talk about this scene and I keep remembering that actually Cameron wasn't there. And again, it feels really odd that she wouldn't at least get, you know, Debbie got a computer. Will Cameron get one shipped to her house as a sort of like, here's Gordon being like, I'm the big man now. Like, here's yours.
But you just know she's going to smash it if she does, right? She want to see that shit. They ruined it.
True. No. Yeah, no, I know. But still, she was part of it, right? I mean, again, there's a, like, I would love to her for her to be like, yeah, nah. I don't know. I think, and we didn't really see Boss in this episode, did we? I mean, he's gone.
No, he's effectively on ice now, isn't he? And we don't even really know, is he supposed to be in prison? Like, we don't even really know what happened there. We just know that he's kind of vanished. But it's interesting, we're talking about all those kind of long cinematic shots in Cardiff, like that long view and the boardroom scene, and then this quick editing around the opening and all that kind of stuff. And then we get presented with the origins of Mutiny, and it couldn't feel or be shot any more differently. The one bit of kind of continuity that I spotted is like the red paint on the wall was clearly a kind of callback to the red paint on the stand in Comdex, which is the last time I think that Cameron really felt in control of anything at Cardiff. Like, after that, it all went downhill for her. And now she's kind of branching out and doing her own thing. But all those shots feel tight. It feels like a really like closed, like narrow space, but not in a bad way. It just feels very commune-y, everyone packed in on top of each other.
There's tons of light, and yeah, if you tons. Guys follow us on Twitter, you'll know that we use a couple of those GIFs a lot. And there's the one of Cameron smiling, and there's just such a light shining on her. And it's not the same angelic light that we've seen in some episodes where she's in complete darkness, but rather natural light
loads
bouncing
of
off her silhouette. And it's great to see. And she's, you know, you mentioned the color red. We've sort of, if you don't remember her look from episode 7, where she confronts Simon and she's wearing that red suit, and her her hair looks different. It looks sharper. And it's not this, right? It's completely pacifist. The red is there to highlight the boldness of this venture and not to threaten. And so you have this sort of red stamp on a very welcoming space. And I'm really looking forward to seeing where that goes. And I feel like, again, you're totally right. They played around with the elements that made the show and completely flipped them for this other sort of scenario that was taking place. And we know they've done this before, where the light follows Cameron, right? Her look follows her into a scene with other characters. And so this sort of contrast to Cardiff Electric, mm-hmm. and even to some of the other spaces we found ourselves in over the past season, it's kind of like the light at the end of the tunnel from that point of view, right? I mean, Gordon, I've said it, like, is looking into darkness. Joe, he's kind of looking into the stars, and it could go either way. He could be looking into darkness with some light, you know, sprinkled throughout. But it's a really interesting concept, again, with the whole symbolism.
But Cameron and Donna are literally seeing the light.
Yeah.
Like, they are going, they're moving towards, and Cameron especially, they're moving towards something that just seems much fresher, much newer, much more positive. I totally, totally agree with you. And it's what's beautiful about it is we don't know. And look, if Christopher Cantwell ever wants to come and confirm a few questions, like, we're definitely not going to turn down the invitation, but we don't know at this point whether they knew that they were renewed or not. And it works either way. Like, if they're renewed, you've got this whole massive question of, you know, what happens in Mutiny? And if they're not, then it's that lovely little positive note at the end going, look, something grew out of this. Like, some kernel, like, started to grow out of whatever kind of chaos came before. And I love that it works. Even if it didn't get renewed, it would have worked anyway.
This season hasn't been as dramatic for there to be tons of question marks around certain things either, right? It's not that kind of show. It's not how to get away with murder where you're like, you know, sorry guys, but you know how every season ends, right? It's like with a cliffhanger to the next one. So we're not quite in that territory, but you're right. I mean, it doesn't really tie things up. It sets things up in a way that you're either okay with where they end up, or it gives them a little bit of, you know, seeds to grow into the next season. Now, can we talk about Joe setting the truck on fire?
I have a really, really fun fact about this scene, because when he was throwing the lighter in and it all went up, and then he throws in his jacket, which I'd forgotten, but was a really nice touch. I was like, this music that's playing, it doesn't sound 80s to me. And up until now, I think other than score, every time we've heard music, it has been of the era or of an earlier one.
And from Cameron. Yeah.
But actually, and I did write it down and I've lost the date, but that song is a much, much later song. It's much more recent. And it's called, the genius of this, considering what an absolute garbage fire this year has been, the song is called 2020.
Really?
I'm guessing was more a reference to Vision than to this, but it's like, wait, 2020, the great garbage fire. I saw that, and actually I whooped out loud when I Googled that one, because it just made me laugh so hard. So Gordon, so Joe, sorry, and Chris's one and two, and Juan, they really knew what they were what they were doing with this one. They could see into the future. They could see it all being burnt down.
But also the episode called 1984, which also talks about our current state of hyper surveillance. So two in one there.
Yes, that I felt like that was an observation someone could easily have made in the early when was this being filmed? 2014,
yeah,
I think. Or 2013, 2014. I feel like that state of the world observation of 1984 could probably have been made then quite comfortably. But the seeing ahead to 2020 being the biggest of all the garbage fires was pretty impressive. So yes, but anyway, Joe blowing it all up because he has to, apparently. That's how he has to leave things.
Yeah, I mean, we hadn't seen him destroy stuff in a while, so...
That's true, and he broke his baseball bat, didn't he? So the first time we saw him doing destruction in the stereo shop, it was more kind of baseball bat type stuff, and then he sort of swung it around in his house a bit, but then he broke it. That was his last big tantrum, was breaking the baseball bat and breaking his ties to his dad. So I guess this was the only logical next step was that. And they kind of... juxtapose that with the carjacking, right? So Gordon finally succumbs to a status symbol of this ridiculous car. And I did think it was rather neat that at the beginning of season one, we have Donna turning up to collect a drunk Gordon from jail in their old family car. And now at the end of season one, you've got Gordon in his kind of fancy penis mobile taking drunk Donna home. And then it all goes horribly wrong because Gordon can't ever be pretend to be anything he's not. He's not allowed that. The universe is not going to let Gordon Clark be anything other than Gordon Clark. That whole thing then mapped onto Joe's like destruction of everything that he feels that he's failed at. There were some beautiful kind of parallels and lovely ideas behind all that.
Sorry, very quickly, to go back to the fire in the scene, because I looked into a couple of fun facts, is that the score doesn't really have track names, but one of them is referenced as Still on Fire, and it's the music that plays during the opening title card and pre-commercial credits. So actually, when you think about it, we are finally seeing them catch fire, which is true to the show's name, right?
Nice.
We're there. The other little thing is that there was a really fun scene where Joe is sort of challenging the developers to come up with a killer app, right, for this delay that he wants to do, to ship it with something worthwhile. And actually, the term app was never used until Apple launched the App Store in 2008.
I wondered about that because I do not remember. Like, okay, so I got my first computer, which was Windows 3.1 when I was 15. And then we upgraded it to Windows 95. And I don't remember the word app being used for a really, really long time as a like application. Yes, because you would see that in the folders and you would see that when you installed stuff. And it was used, I think, in tech circles a bit more. But I didn't remember it being used quite in this kind of way so commonly. Now, of course, Joe is on the development side of things, so you would expect him to use it ahead of the kind of general population, obviously. But it didn't feel entirely natural.
No, and you, I mean, I'm from South America, so things don't quite translate as well in terms of what you call software, but it's always been sort of referenced as program, right? So
yeah, there are some interesting little bits. At one point, Joe, I think it's when he's about to go, and he's looking for where he can go to the observatory, and it's either him or the guy he's talking to, says route rather than route, which it's the British pronunciation. And I just thought that right. It was funny. It was one, I wrote it down just because it stood out at me. I was like, oh, he didn't say that in the way that I expected him to say it. And I think in my head, it all got kind of mixed up with, is app a thing that they were saying at the time? And, you know, it's funny. It was just like little tiny things in this episode that were just little curiosities.
I don't think it was, and let alone in the Silicon Prairie. But again, it was great to see sort of these things come to light, I guess. But also the idea of a killer app, right? I mean, what was the landscape of technology back then?
Well, doesn't he? He says Lotus as his... I barely remember that existing. Like,
yeah,
that's dead and gone.
So I think to summarize what we usually do as soon as we jump into recording is that I think we both really liked the episode. I mean, I really liked the episode. Yeah. I think whilst it didn't capture the same level of intrigue, I guess, or momentum as maybe episode 7 or 8, I felt pretty satisfied with the finale. And I think that overall, except some of those maybe weird time jumps that got Cameron into a whole new company right away, it felt pretty cohesive. It felt pretty like a natural progression of where the characters should go. And as a fan, sort of satisfied in terms of where the characters have gotten to. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Absolutely. I think, like I said earlier, I feel like it did a very balanced, very good, solid season one finale kind of thing. Like, you don't want your season one finale to feel like the end of the entire show. You want it to feel like it ties up a few things, leaves open a few others. But if the show were canceled at this point and never finished, like, you wouldn't be left with this kind of like, what happened there then? You wouldn't be left with a kind of feeling of irritation because you think, okay, well, at least I understand that Joe went off to do something else. Gordon got everything he wanted and didn't know if it was a poison chalice. Cameron went off to start her own thing, which felt fairly inevitable from the beginning. And Donna is the big question mark because it's like, oh, she's going to do something interesting. We don't know what. We don't know what her motivations are enough to this point. And it's interesting because you mentioned Cameron's costume before. We get some great costume cues from Donna in this one. So like when she goes into her appraisal, she's still very much wearing her work suits, a little bit sharper maybe, but like very much in her pink and beige. And then they have that party and she wears her glammed up black dress and her amazing hair. And you just like, you really get the sense of her being middle class again. Like, you, that's like class difference with Gordon that's come through a few times in a few episodes. You get the idea that she comes from a little bit of money again. And then she goes to Mutiny with like practically like a 1950s headscarf and like jeans, right? She turns up looking like weirdly kind of like 1950s, 60s mom going to do her new professional job. And so her costume cues are fascinating. Her evolution is really interesting because you're expecting her to go in the Gordon kind of status symbol direction. And she doesn't do that at all. In fact, if anything, she strips it all back and goes back to school almost.
So that bit reminded me a little bit, and I was reading about this today, maybe this is why, of Alicia Florek in The Good Wife and her sort of coming back to the world of the law after not having practiced, for giving up her career essentially to just be a wife and a mother, yep. Right? I mean, in the first season, Alicia goes into a law firm for the first time in what, 20 years or something like that. So it did sort of give me that.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a lot more confident, I think, right? I mean, yeah. Donna isn't necessarily scared.
No, but... and she's been recruited for her skills. It's not like I guess in Alicia's case, she's, you know, pulled a string with an old friend to get back on the ladder. And it's more like going back to school. But still, Donna is trying something completely new. She's trying something that, like, is in her own world. It's not a sort of adjunct to Gordon's. And yes, she was at TI before and that was her own thing, but she wasn't doing very much. She certainly wasn't using all her skills. And again, you got the impression that, you know, she was there because she knew Hunt, maybe, or not that he got her the job, but clearly she had connections and ties to that world and all the rest of it. Whereas this is a Cameron came to her specifically, headhunted her, but it's a brave new world, right? It's completely different to everything she's used to. And she's in that world with a bunch of kind of overgrown man children who are very bright and very capable and very childish. And you know, it's a whole other thing than she has ever been used to, except that, you know, obviously she's had to deal with Gordon for years and years. So Lev and Yo-Yo shouldn't pose any problems.
I'm looking forward to seeing how season two, what is it going to focus on? And what's that going to mean for everyone? Like you said, like, is Donna going to be a mom to these people now? Like, is she going to be a babysitter, or is she really going to be able to get in there and like break some shit?
And one of the nice things is, like, I remember big beats of the show and I remember small details, but I don't remember everything in between in the right order necessarily. So when we do talk about this, and I think we'll do that whole kind of season one wrap up episode and what we think of season two and la la la, we'll actually be able to quite honestly go, we can't remember exactly what happens next with this and how much emphasis is placed on this or that. We just kind of remember the big beats going forward. So hopefully we'll be able to kind of prognosticate a bit without like falling into, I wonder if this happens territory, which, like, we promise never to do. We won't lead you guys. We won't do that.
No, you were very transparent. Great. I mean, I feel like this brings us to a natural end to our discussion on episode 10, which feels wild to have gotten here. And you know, it's been such a great rewatch.
I can't believe we got here before Amazon Prime screwed us over and tried to take it off the platform. So
can we watch every single episode in how long? 6 days?
We've got 5 days left as of recording this. So we're recording this on the 11th of October, guys. You've got 5 days, unless you hear it after then, in which case I'm afraid you've got no time at all. But you should buy it because it's a great show and you should support the shows that you want to see.
That's, you know, that's really true. And we've seen a lot of articles coming out during the pandemic and during lockdown around people discovering it for the first time because it was available on Netflix and it was sort of billed by critics as a very bingeable show. Now, I am having some discussions with my very good friend Matt, who has been watching and keeping himself to a weekly schedule. And we always talk about the fact that that's how I watched it in the beginning because I watched it live, whereas you, Alex G, watched it whenever and as much as you could, right?
Yeah, I binged it twice basically. So I binged it with her, then had a small break and then binged it again. So
right. And I mean, I think it speaks to the quality of the show that you're actually able to do both. I mean, I feel like maybe some episodes don't really lend themselves to being sort of binge worthy. Again, I'm sorry I keep mentioning this, but The Americans, I didn't realize how slow some of it was for you to really be able to take it in and get a break and really think about what happened in that episode. So yeah, I feel like a lot of people are rediscovering the show or even discovering it for the first time. And I hope that whoever picks up the show after Amazon, whoever Amazon hands the torch to, can be as accessible and speak to even a new audience.
Absolutely. I hope they know what they have because, I mean, we were laughing the other day because somebody tweeted, you know, what was the show with the best ending ever? And Christopher Cantwell retweeted it and went, mine. And he's right. You know, he's being a bit of a Cameron about it, but he's absolutely right. That it, you know, it, we know it's building somewhere really, really special. So that's the only kind of sense of a spoiler that I ever want to give is like, guys, stick with it. Because if you think this first season has been good, you really ain't seen nothing yet. And I hope wherever it lands in the UK, people find it, discover it for the first time, stick with it through the ups and downs of the first season into what turns out to be, what turned out to be basically one of the best shows you and I have ever seen and the reason that we created this.
And with that, our usual speech of, first of all, thank you so much for listening. And you can find us in every episode across your streaming platform of choice. And actually, we are now also live on Amazon Prime Music. So if you have that, and I hope you do, because you're watching this show on Amazon Prime Video for the next 5 days, please listen to us there if you'd like. And you can find us on Twitter, and I will let Alex G give you the handle. Sorry to mess it up.
It's TTT, GYTTT, the thing that gets you to the thing. Please do tweet us stuff. It's mostly me checking it. So my apologies in advance if I don't see it for a day or two, but I will always reply when I see things. We'd share cool stuff that we find as well that to do with the show, some cool artwork, a brilliant one of our listeners sent us a link to this brilliant piece of coding that they did, where it's a choose your own adventure game that takes you through things that did happen in the show and things that could have happened in the show. And she obviously put quite a bit of love into that. So that's worth hunting through our Twitter feed to go and find. And if you see these things out in the wild, if you see great artwork or great projects or great things that link to the show, articles, whatever they are, hit us up. We love seeing them and we get very excited to see them still because it's such a great show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And we'll catch you on the next one.